from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. Food Stamp Program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is being cut back. Last week came the first bite, more cuts likely on the way, depending on what Congress does with SNAP funding in the pending farm bill. SNAP benefits are not high living. $1.40 a meal is where they're headed. But one in seven Americans are now on food stamps post-recession. 47 million people. That has stirred a lot of debate over values, priorities, health, hunger, fairness, the budget, the U.S. economy. This hour on Point, food stamp cuts and this nation's priorities. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's important here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk with a psychologist who studies the long-term impact of hunger and poverty, or scarcity as he calls it, on the brain. But first, the food stamps. Here's the sound of an Idaho mom, Jennifer Horton, mother of three, works part-time and whose husband works full-time in Boise. This weekend, she told the local TV station KBOI-2 that her family may have to start skipping meals because of SNAP cuts.
If we didn't have the SNAP program, we would really be in a world of hurt. It would be a situation of whether or not we pay our power bill or we buy food for our kids so that our kids can eat. We've cut pretty much everything down to the bare bones that we can so that we can keep a roof over our head and everything else. It's going to be a stretch for us. At the end of the month, it's like saying you don't need to eat the last week of the month.
But the criticism goes to who will pay for what. In September on Fox News, Republican from Virginia House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said the current welfare system, including the food stamp system, is not fair for all Americans.
If somebody is abusing the system, or if somebody somehow gets used to a life of dependency, how is it fair for the working middle class of this country to have overtime to go to work two jobs to help pay for that?
We're going to hear that debate in this hour. But first, joining me from Washington is Eli Saslow, staff writer for The Washington Post, author of an excellent ongoing series in The Post on food stamps. Eli, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So remind us of just what happened last week. This was a temporary, supposed to be bump up that's now being ratcheted back. What's happening, Eli?
Yeah, sure. So the stimulus money that went into the food stamp program has expired, which has meant that for most families, it's about a 5%, or in some cases even a little bit more than that, cut to the money that they're getting every month. That might not sound like a lot, but the amount of money that they're getting, like you said earlier, is not very much to begin with. So when you go from something like having $1.70 or $1.80 to spend on a meal, and now you're talking about $1.40 or $1.45, that starts to feel like a pretty big difference. So I think a lot of people are not only dealing with that, but now fearing that probably in the next months, more cuts and potentially more drastic cuts are coming.
What was the idea behind this temporary bump up in SNAP, in food stamps?
As the economy was struggling so much and continues to struggle so much for a lot of people, the idea was that giving people a little bit more money towards their food stamps not only would help some families get through, but that money sort of acts as a stimulus to the economy. And one of the things that's happened over the last several years is that, food stamps have sort of become a cycle, an economic cycle on their own, and a cycle that a lot of towns have come to rely on. So this money comes in once a month to people, and not only does it help the people who are getting that money, but then they go out and they spend it in stores, and that keeps the stores healthy and alive. And it gives people jobs in the stores. The stores then hire people to work there. And we're not talking about a small amount of money. In some places, there are plenty of towns where 40 or 45% of people are receiving food stamps, and you're talking about millions, if not billions of dollars coming into towns and states all at once that have sort of helped keep them alive.
That number is incredible. 40 or 45% of a town's population on food stamps. That is both ammunition for supporters of the program who say it's needed and ammunition for opponents who say, look, this has become too widespread and undergirding of our population. Remind us how the rollback of the stimulus money is going to happen. It's not just last Friday. This will go on, right, month after month?
It will go on month after month. And you know, it's going to be a major change for a lot of people who've come to rely on that money and a lot of communities that have come to rely on it too. But I think it's sort of exacerbated right now by the debate in Congress, that it looks like the outcome will be difficult either way for families receiving food stamps. But, you know, one version of the bill has been passed that would cut $4 billion, and another version has been passed that would cut $40 billion over the next 10 years. And the House and the Senate will be fighting over that and trying to work out a compromise on that number. Either way, it will be a pretty rough outcome, I think, for a lot of people who are receiving food stamp money every month.
So some of the cuts, the rollback, will be off the stimulus bump up. And the rest is depending how the farm bill comes out, I guess, how deep those cuts there, because this is right at the heart of the U.S. farm bill.
Yeah, it is right at the heart of the U.S. farm bill. It's sort of a counterintuitive way to fund a food stamp program. But basically, you know, a long time ago, the Congress decided it made sense to combine food stamps with the farm bill because people, legislators from more rural areas had trouble getting inner city legislators to vote for farm policy. And conversely, people from cities had a tough time getting more rural legislators to vote for food stamp policy. So they combined them into the same bill. And when that started, it was still mostly a farm bill, and most of the money was for farm subsidies. As the food stamp program has grown from, $20 billion to $80 billion just in the last 12 or 13 years, the farm bill really is a food stamp bill, and 80% of the bill deals with the food stamp program. It's the fastest domestic spending item in the government over the last decade. So that's made the farm bill a very controversial bill and a hard one to pass.
Those numbers make clear why budget hawks would be concerned about this, from $20 billion to $80 billion in that period of time. That's a huge increase. What's driven the doubling of enrollment and the tripling of the program's cost? What's behind that, Eli?
It's a few things. I mean, the biggest of them is that the economy has been really lousy for a lot of people for a long time, and people who used to make more money now make less and qualify for food stamps when they didn't before. And even now, as the economy has started to get better, it's such a low wage recovery that a lot of people who have gone back to work are going back to $8 an hour, $9 an hour part-time jobs that still leave them qualified for food stamps. So there are a lot of people who work who are still receiving it depending on these. But the other and sort of more controversial reasons for its growth is that states around the country have realized that, this federal money is really important to them, and they want to bring this federal food stamp money into their states. So states have hired by the hundreds people whose job it is to sort of go out and promote food stamps and help encourage people who qualify to sign up. So, in the last decade, we've gone from having about half of the eligible people for food stamps sign up to about 75% of them sign up. And that's a change that results in millions more people on food stamps and billions more dollars being spent.
Now, I'm reading here numbers in 2012, average benefit per person about $133 per month. It adds up to a lot, but for a particular person, that's not a lot of money when it comes to eating, to food.
No, it's not a lot at all. I mean, I've had the privilege over this last year of spending a lot of time with families who are living on that amount. And this is a program that, in the best case, the federal government says is intended to help you buy food for 17 days in the month. So that's 17 hard days, and it still leaves 13 days totally unaccounted for. So the cycle that you see in a lot of places is, sort of from the first of the month to the 30th of the month, the refrigerator and the cupboards getting more and more empty. And then what happens is food pantries are much more busy in the second half of the month. Some don't even open in the first half of the month when they know that people will have food from buying them with food stamps. And then the second half of the month now, sort of food stamps and food banks in the country are totally overwhelmed.
I'm reading here, fruits, vegetables, grain products, meats, dairy products make up about 90% of the food that SNAP households buy. Goes against some old stereotypes. Incredibly low average income here, $8,800 a year on average. For people who household income, for people who receive SNAP benefits, I mean, overwhelmingly children, disabled, and elderly make up the bulk of this.
That's exactly right. I think it's almost exactly half of those who receive food stamps are children. And that's what's made the program, I think, very difficult to cut. Nobody wants to be taking food away from kids who need it. There are a lot of children like that in this country right now, that the levels of food insecurity are high everywhere. I just got back from a reporting trip to South Texas, and I was in a county there, Hidalgo County, near the border, where 40% of children experience food insecurity every month. That means that once a month, they're not quite sure where their next meal might be coming from. And that cuts across partisan lines. I think that's something that everybody's concerned about. So it makes this program very difficult to cut, and to cut drastically.
But what does it say about an economy that leaves that many people needing government support to eat? I mean, it may be a problem for the government, and the budget also seems to be some kind of problem baked into the economy right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Baked into the economy. And I think some people would tell you baked into the culture. I mean, and that's sort of what's at the heart sometimes of the fight about, how much is it the government's responsibility to help people, and how much should people sort of be responsible for helping themselves?
This is the charge of a culture of dependency.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The charge of a culture of dependency. And I think particularly on the right in Congress, there's a feeling that what the food stamp program does is it treats the symptoms of poverty, but it's not very good at solving poverty. And people stay on the program in some cases for a long time, years, even decades. And that becomes sort of a systematic thing that people are concerned about.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about food stamps and American priorities. Cuts last week, more likely coming. Hunger we're looking at. The economy we're looking at. Priorities and the budget. First round of cuts last Friday. There are more to come. Here's Connie James, former food stamp recipient, director of the Heartland's Hands Food Bank in South Haven, Mississippi, saying here her shelves will soon run out of food for the increasing number of people coming to the food bank. Here she is on WATN-TV last week.
We give out what we get in, and that's all we can give out. As more people come in, we're doing a lot of praying, and we're doing a lot of asking our community.
There's a lot of need out there, but this has been a hot political issue as well. January last year, town hall meeting in Meredith, New Hampshire, former Republican representative, then presidential candidate Newt Gingrich, went after President Obama on food stamps.
President Obama is the most effective food stamp president in American history. No president has put more people on food stamps than Obama.
Controversial comments by Newt Gingrich right there. It's still hot. The cuts are coming. Eli Saslow has written about it in depth for The Washington Post and joins us today from Washington. I want to get into the debate now that has been rippling through Washington and no doubt will continue. With us from Springfield, Oregon, is Congressman Peter DeFazio. Democrat, represents Oregon's 4th District, includes Eugene. He opposes cuts to the SNAP program. He went grocery shopping in August as an experiment to see what he could buy with $30 worth of food stamps, and it doesn't go all that far. With us from Washington is Michael Tanner, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, libertarian think tank, heads up research on social policy. Congressman DeFazio, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
And Michael Tanner in Washington, thank you for joining us, Michael.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Congressman DeFazio, first to you. 1 in 7 sounds like a big number. 46, 47 million people is a big number. And now we've got cuts coming. Justified or not?
No, look, I'm for reducing the federal deficit. How about cutting the subsidies to agribusiness that are in this bill? They have 5 new programs. They're pretending to do away with paying people not to grow things, but actually, according to Heritage and the American Enterprise Institute, these programs are going to explode and cost much more. We have the supplemental coverage option, the shallow loss coverage, which is free. Both those things are free. Agricultural risk coverage. Farmers have to pay 35% of the cost. And then the stated income protection plan, which is going to guarantee peanut growers a profit and rice growers a profit and cotton growers a profit every year. If you want to make cuts in the ag budget, let's not take, food out of the mouths of hungry seniors and kids. Let's cut the subsidies to big agriculture.
Michael Tanner, let's look elsewhere for the cuts. Why go to America's hungry poorest?
Well, let's start off with the fact that I agree entirely with the congressman. The agricultural subsidies in this bill are entirely unjustifiable. They are nothing more than a giveaway to big agriculture. That said, that doesn't mean the food stamp program should be exempt from reform. I certainly think simply things that they're talking about, such as reinstating the work requirements for the program that were in place prior to the recession, or ending categorical eligibility so that recipients have to undergo asset tests again, once again. Those sorts of things are simply common sense reforms.
Congressman, would you bring those back, work requirements and, prove you need it requirements?
Well, I voted for the welfare reform in the Clinton era, which did put in place work training programs. But if there isn't work available, that's a pretty tough requirement. I'll give you an example. Josephine County, my district, highest number of people on food stamps in my district, over 30%. The last sawmill just closed. Okay, guys, sorry. Gee, you went from $700-$800 a week to $200 on unemployment. And, oh, by the way, you can't have food stamps unless you're working, except you were working and you want to work. Or the Portland, Oregonian featured a woman who's in her 30s. She's been struggling. She's got a disabled child, single parent. She finally got a college degree but found out it didn't get her a job. She's now working on a master's in a profession that probably will get her a job. She's working as an intern to try and get experience, taking care as a single mom of her child, and she says the food stamps are critical for their monthly budget. Or the seniors. Remember, 22% of the people on this program are seniors who are going to say, get off your retired butt and go, or disabled and go back to work. Come on. It's an overly broad, attack on the program.
Michael Tanner, I mean, what about the problem with the economy here? We've had an economy that's done just fine by the wealthiest Americans, not done well by any measure, really, for the poor and the middle class. A bunch of them have been pushed down into the ranks of the poor. When we're looking at that, how can you start booting people off of the only support they may have?
Well, first of all, it's hardly the only support they may have. Remember, there's the S in Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is the official name for food stamps, stands for supplemental. The idea is that you're not supposed to be living on just food stamps. And in fact, most people who are receiving food stamps receive other types of aid, or they have other forms of income in their households. This is not meant to be their sole source of support.
I don't mean to suggest that, but it is for many of them the only support. They may have other things, but in terms of government support, I mean, here we've got an economy that's not making well-paying jobs. We've got, people who are working at McDonald's or Walmart and still need food stamps to put food on the table. What do we do about that issue?
Well, we should certainly be trying to create more better-paying jobs. I'm all for that. But let's remember the explosion in food stamp participation actually started under George W. Bush long before the recession. Newt Gingrich was wrong. Essentially, George W. Bush nearly doubled the food stamp rolls. It almost doubled again under President Obama. And if you look at the projections from the CBO, even after the unemployment rates come back down and the recession's recovery's fully in place, they project that the current levels are going to continue.
So there, when you look at that, Congressman DeFazio, how do we handle that? We're not creating these jobs with better income, but you've got this growth upon growth in the food stamp program. Where does that go?
Well, that is a commentary on what's happening in America with income disparities, money being upstream to the top, and opportunities for middle class and average kind of jobs are disappearing. More and more service sector. Sure, I agree we need to create more better paying jobs, but that's a bigger subject than for today. It goes to trade policy and a host of other things in America, lack of investment in infrastructure. But let's go back to the facts here. 22% of the people on food stamps are on Social Security retirement or disability. I don't think anybody's going to say, let's push them off retirement. They are people living on $10,000, $12,000 a month. They need this.
A year.
41% are working, have one working person in the family. But, yeah, the wages are inadequate. You can't get by on one, if it's a two-parent family, you can't get by on one salary anymore given the decline in wages, particularly in hard-hit areas of my district and elsewhere. And then finally, half of them are kids. Yeah, get a paper route. I mean, come on. Now, at some point, I don't begrudge giving people who are hungry something to eat. I went shopping on this budget before it was reduced, and it was absurd. you know, what I was contemplating for a week of sustenance. I mean, you know, that it's what a lot of average, well, I'd say your average lobbyist, it's a heck of a lot more than they spend on lunch one day.
Congressman Michael Tanner, stand by. We've got listeners, callers for you. Norma in Pella, Iowa is calling. Hi, Norma, you're on the air. What do you see?
Yes. I think that the cuts in the food stamp program are especially hard on the elderly because did you know that the since the 1990s, the cost of living raises for seniors do not include food or fuel?
So it gets tighter and tighter as...
And we've lost a lot of income over those years, and this little bump in the food stamp program did help a lot, and now that's been taken away. And I just wish that people would know that seniors and their cost of living increases are not getting their food and fuel covered.
Norma, is this an issue for you personally?
It is.
And
on the average income there that you mentioned.
Right. I mean, when Michael Tanner says, look, when critics say, look, we've got budget problems in this country, we have to cut somewhere, this is growing awfully fast, let's cut here, what are you thinking?
I guess I look at myself especially and those other poor families, and I can't understand, as you say, priorities. And there are people that will volunteer at these food pantries and so on, and then they vote for these representatives that are bound and determined to cut any kind of food assistance. I can't understand it.
Michael,
it's just a disconnect, I think, with these people.
Michael Tanner, what do you say to Norma in Iowa?
Well, I would say that we need to, you know, certainly the elderly and children, those are people we want to help out, but we also have to look at the 4.5 million able-bodied adults without disabilities who are on the food stamp program and is requiring them to work too much of a restriction. Is requiring that applicants undergo an asset test to qualify for the benefits so that they don't have a great deal, you know, money sitting in the bank while they're getting getting government assistance. Is that unreasonable? We're talking about cuts that would return the food stamp spending to the level we had in 2010. 2010 was not known as the year of the Great American Famine.
Mm-hmm. Eli Saslow, you're listening to all this from the Washington Post there. Do you see significant issues with abuse of this program, Eli?
I think there are some, but I think that the most interesting thing about writing about this program is that there aren't easy solutions, and that's the frustrating part too. It's complicated and difficult to solve. I mean, I spent a lot of time with Representative Steve Sutherland in Congress, who sort of is the main force behind trying to push work requirements. And he's not doing it because he wants people to be hungry. He's doing it because he genuinely believes people will improve their lives more by finding jobs than they will by living on food stamps. But the problems are that, you know, it's easy to say that, but right now there's not money to connect those people with job training programs, and there might not be jobs for all of them. And you know, if they're unable to get jobs and there is a work requirement, what then happens to their children who are receiving food stamps through them when they're kicked off the program because they can't find work? I mean, there are no easy ways to untangle this, which is why I think it's something that luckily people are putting a lot of thought into to try to find ways to kind of unravel the string.
Let's go to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Nikita. Nikita, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I wanted to make a comment about how important I think the food stamp program is, because my husband and I are both full-time students at a university, and we both work part-time, and we have two children, and we really depend on the program to feed our children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we didn't have this program, it would be deciding between, well, should we pay, you know, our light bill and our water bill, or should we, you know, buy groceries for the kids? So
now, Nikita, yeah. The critics who say this encourages the wrong values might say, hey, you've got kids. Maybe you can't afford to go to school. Maybe you should both just be working full time and get off government support.
Well, I would argue that the point of us going to school is so that we can get better jobs, and that way we don't have to keep working minimum wage jobs that would keep us on the, you know, would keep us dependent on these kinds of programs.
Michael,
versus if we were, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I just want to get Michael in here. Stand by, Nikita. Michael, what about this as a test of the values argument here? Nikita says, look, we're trying to move up in the economy, help the economy move up, get an education, and we need food stamp help while we're doing that. We're working part-time, but we're also going to school full-time. What do you say to that? Good use of the program, Michael?
Well, I certainly think her going to school and her husband going to school is a way to get out of poverty over the long term. We know that education is crucially important there. We also know that a large number of food stamp recipients don't use it just as a temporary assistance. About half of food stamp benefits now are paid to people who've been on the program for 5 years or longer. So increasingly this is becoming sort of a long-term welfare program instead of a short-term help.
But if they're elderly or young children, it's not surprising if they'd be on it for 5 years.
Well, that's true, although even with the elderly and long-term, the answer should be try to finding ways to lift them out of poverty rather than to find ways to continue to make poverty a bit more comfortable for them.
Nikita, what's it going to take out of your budget, your menu, these cuts?
I'm sorry?
What's it going to take out of your household menu, your meals, the cuts that we're seeing here?
For us, health is really important, and with the food stamps program, we're able to buy healthful foods, whole grains, milk, fruits, vegetables, things that, are healthy to live on. And if we were to get cut even more, we just wouldn't be able to eat as healthy as we should. And here, in America, we're trying to fight obesity and teach our children, they should be eating right. But how can we do that when the cheapest food is the food that's the worst for you to eat?
And Nikita, I really appreciate your call, and I wish you luck. Congressman DeFazio, how do we get out of this bind? Here we've got an economy that's not producing good enough jobs at the bottom and even the middle. On the other hand, we've got plenty of budget issues in this country, and these enrollments have swollen. How do we get out of this without leaving people hungry or, giving bad incentives on the values front, certainly not leaving people just hungry in the street?
Well, if you remember, Michael agreed with me at the beginning there on cutting the subsidies, the massive new subsidy programs to agriculture. If we set a target for the ag programs and say, let's reduce them $50 billion, all of that could come out of these new subsidized insurance or new free insurance programs that we're going to establish. Then we've met that target. Then let's deal with the long-term unemployment and other problems. I tell you, my unemployed mill workers would be happy to take, let's say a WPA-type job. We got a lot of work that needs being done in the forest. Some of them are loggers. They could go out there and do fuel reduction if the government had the money. Say, okay, look, if you're going to get food stamps, you got to work, and we're going to actually provide a job at a decent wage that's productive for society. I mean, there are not a lot of opportunities out there for people. And I think, Nikita just, really nailed it when she talked about what you can buy on these benefits. I mean, I look back, I've still got my receipt, very, very heavy on starch at these levels. I mean, I congratulate her on being able to find, afford healthy food for her kids and herself and her husband on this level of benefits. And then finally, the point about which Michael made about we want to figure out how to get these people out of poverty. Well, guess what? We're going the other way on Social Security. There's a lot of people out there, I don't know about Cato, but a lot of others saying, let's chain the CPI for seniors. It's overly generous. Let's reduce it. So we're not looking at ways to help seniors who are, stuck in retirement on what's not even adequate to put good food on the table. Or, again, the whole generation of kids. I mean, half the recipients are kids. What do we want them to be healthy? Do we want them to be non-obese? Do we want them to be able to learn in school and not sit there thinking about the next meal? I've been to schools where 80% of the kids in my district in Springfield are on the free school lunch program, and actually some of the proposals in the House bill would cut back on the free school lunch program.
There's the debate right on the table. Congressman Peter DeFazio in Oregon's 4th District with us from Springfield, Oregon. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Michael Tanner at the Cato Institute, thank you for joining us, Mr. Tanner.
A pleasure.
Eli Saslow, we will continue to read your coverage in the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us, Eli.
I appreciate it. Take care.
When we return, we will look at the impact of nutritional issues on the brain. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking this hour about the recent cuts to food stamps and more on the way. Now, poverty and hunger from a different angle, what they do to our minds. Princeton psychologist Eldar Shafir says that scarcity of food, money, time affects the brain's ability to function in some dramatic and lasting ways. His new book, co-authored with Sandeel Mulla Nathan, is Scarcity: Why Having Too Little Means So Much. He joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. Eldar Shafir, thank you very much for being here today. What have you found?
Well, hi, Tom. Well, we've looked at essentially the cognitive capacity of people to handle, you know, difficult times, difficult circumstances, and scarcity, when you feel you don't have enough money, calories, time, captures a lot of your attention and just leaves less mind to deal with other matters in your everyday life.
Let's start with calories and nutrition. Are you talking about childhood development here or something broader?
No, our analysis is very much a cognitive one. There's a lot of work, of course, on the physiological effects of hunger, et cetera. We're really looking at the psychology of the cognitive psychology, the attentional impact of not having enough, how it leads you to focus on the thing you don't have enough of. You might do quite well trying to think of how to procure more of it, how to save your money, how to be efficient with your time. But at the same time, everything else in the periphery gets neglected, often at high cost.
So you're saying whether children or adults, if there's an environment of scarcity, it cuts into what? How people perceive the world, how they behave in it?
All of those things. So, you know, we do studies where we have, you know, low-income people consider some financial concerns that they have in their everyday life. And we show that at those moments when they're concerned about their finances, they just do less well on logical and IQ tests compared to earlier when they were not concerned with those financial matters. So just going around with those concerns in your mind affects your cognition, your ability to attend, to remember things you need to do, to think clearly.
How does that work psychologically or physiologically? What's the connection between scarcity and a reduced sort of quality of thought?
Well, we have a very limited bandwidth. We just walk around with only so much we can think of at any one time. There are a lot of studies the last 3 decades. If I simply have you, Tom, rehearse a 7-digit number in your mind, try not to forget a 7-digit number, while you're doing that, you're just going to notice less things in the periphery. You're going to drive less well. You're going to be less good at resisting foods you'd like not to eat. Your mind is just distracted by this task you're doing right now. And in some sense, when you're dealing with intense financial pressures, it's like keeping that number in your mind at all time.
So give us some sort of practical portrait of how this shows up in the lives of the poor in your findings.
Well, in one case, for example, to have a very clean study, we try to do this within the same people. So we get around confounds of education and intention and personality. We went to farmers in India who do sugarcane farming. And they're a good candidate because these people get the bulk of their income only once a year. And because they live, you know, in relatively difficult circumstances and fail to smooth, as you say, they basically find themselves poor before harvest and rich after. So we go to the same people 3-4 months apart, before harvest when they're poor and after harvest when they're rich, and we'll give them a battery of tests. And we show that basically in times of poverty, the same person, otherwise, you know, everything is controlled for, same education, same health, the same person when they're poor just do less well. They respond to IQ tests less well. They're less good at dividing their attention between things they need to do and things they need to resist. They're just less capable in their everyday lives.
So look around American society. We've been talking today about food stamps and nutrition. It goes wider than that. But how do you see this dynamic showing up in the United States?
Well, it's a beautiful question. And there's two ways to think about it. You can think about giving food stamps, for example, as an attempt to make people's lives just a little bit nicer. Or you can see it as something that they absolutely must have in an attempt to juggle very difficult circumstances. From my point of view, you know, these people are putting out fires moment to moment, food on the table, rent that needs to be paid. And basically what you're doing is taking away the little bit of water they have available to them. And the point there is not just an ethical one, but if you look at our data, you literally leave them with less capacity to deal with their issues. Even job searches will be less effective and less successful if I'm fighting fires with an inability to succeed, as you make my daily financial life and other matters more and more challenging and difficult.
But part of the argument on food stamps, it's along these lines. We encourage bad values with this supplemental nutrition because people come to count on a handout from the government instead of pulling up their, you know, socks and getting out to do the necessary, whatever that is. What does your research say to you about that perspective?
We don't do any direct research on, you know, on the personalities that drive people when they don't have enough. People have done this research. There's very good evidence that low-income people in America are doing the best they can and acting in the most cases quite responsibly, managing a very difficult juggling act and, you know, wasting relatively little. When we look at our data and we look at how the poor, for example, manage their dollar, know about prices, shop responsibly, they're much better than the rich. They're very careful. They know exactly what every dollar brings and how to do trade-offs, and they manage it quite capably. You know, if they come out of a supermarket, they know exactly how much they spent as opposed to many of us who know less well. But as they juggle this very carefully, they just have less mind for other things. And they end up not looking good when they forget to pay their rent or when they attend to their kids less after school and do the kind of the things that happen to you when your bandwidth is taxed.
But if you say, all right, dear fellow citizen who's living in poverty, you seem frazzled. Let me come in and help you with more support. Of course, there is much more support in many countries, in Europe, let's say, but the United States, not so much comparatively. Does that produce better outcomes, or does that produce, a fellow citizen who says, "Well, I don't need to crank it up. I can get by with less effort."
Well, all the evidence seems to suggest that not helping these people doesn't make them do that much better. I mean, obviously there are different levels. At some point, you can give better and better benefits or less good, but you need a certain minimum, according to our research at least, to help people function minimally well so that they can devote part of their mind, part of their bandwidth to things that need to be done. One thing that happens in the U.S. is, you know, we think about personal responsibility a lot. There's a sense in which we resist helping people and want them to take responsibility for their own lives.
Yeah.
And there's one good way to think about this. You know, we compare in the book, we consider aviation and the design of cockpits. Mm-hmm. At some point, when your pilots are very good, the rest depends on how good you design a cockpit. If you design a cockpit badly, good and bad pilots will both fail. If you design a cockpit very, very well, that's the moment when excellent pilots can thrive and succeed. Here, something similar happens. If you design financial circumstances that simply trip me up and make it very hard to succeed, even those who are capable and try very hard will not make it. If you design financial circumstances, everyday life, in ways that at least allow the success of those who are trying hard enough, that's when you let personal responsibility thrive. That's when you let those who are able and trying and care enough to shine and make it through and get out of it potentially.
Eldar Shafir is co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's turn to our listeners. Justin in Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air. What do you think, Justin?
Hi, Tom. I really had a question. I wanted to know, with the work participation rate in the U.S. hovering around, you know, say 63%, I believe it is, what do people do in times of scarcity of resources and food? Do they turn inward to themselves and their family and become more frugal? And what do they do when that's not enough? Do they turn outwardly to the community, to food banks and churches? And what do they do when that's not enough? What is their means of last resort?
Justin, we've got a psychologist, not a sociologist, but let's try it. Eldar, you know, there's the question. The recession came. It put unemployment at terrible highs. Lots of people were forced on to very few resources. So what do you know about how people respond to that? Where they turn their needs and where they turn their energies?
Well, I'll tell you what I know from reading and a little bit what we did in our research. What we know from reading is, of course, all of the above to some extent. A lot of soup kitchens and churches and other places that are extremely important and are able to help people in dire straits. And there's a lot of help going on between friends and families in low-income neighborhoods, much more than we, the more fortunate, tend to spend time helping each other. One thing that we do know from the research is that when things are very, very tough, you resort to what you can reach to help. When there's a fire in your bedroom, you reach for their closest bucket. Some of those buckets come in the form of, for example, high-interest short-term loans, you know, payday loans. Those are cases where when things are really, really bad and you need to feed your kids, you grab a loan. It's easily available. It solves the problem right away. And when you grab that bucket of water, what you do not have enough mind, enough bandwidth to think about is how much is this bucket going to cost me in 2 weeks? That's not the kind of thing you do when you're trying to put down a fire. And so what happens to many of these circumstances in times of extreme gravity you grab what's available, and next you know you owe a very high interest rate, and 2 weeks later you're just a little bit poorer than you were 2 weeks ago, and you get into what we describe in the book as a poverty trap. Things just get worse.
What's the difference, or did you find one, between long-term stress of scarcity and short-term? If it's, you know, for 6 months or a year, I mean, I'm looking at research here that says almost 40% of Americans between 25 and 60 will experience at least 1 year below the poverty line. If it's just a year, does it pass with less of a hit on our effectiveness working, you know, operating in the world? If it's longer, does it multiply?
Well, Tom, that's a deep question. There's, of course, a lot of work on the chronic effects of stress with time. We have focused very much on the cognitive effects, which basically come and go as your problems get closer, you know, harder and easier. So many of our studies, you know, we put people in experiments also in circumstances of scarcity, and they start acting like the poor. They start acting like people who are focused on scarcity, on not having enough, within minutes. So that's a very quick effect.
Well, like, what do you mean exactly again? How does that show up? What's the evidence when you say acting like the poor within minutes?
Well, let's go back to the payday loan. So we take students here at Princeton. These are people who are obviously highly capable and not myopic and very thoughtful.
Yep.
And we put them in circumstances where we make them, you know, by random assignment, either rich or poor in the time they have to play certain games where they collect money and want to succeed. And what we show is that when you're rich enough and I offer you a high interest loan, you can grab a few more seconds for a high interest and lose a lot of time. When you're rich enough, you don't do that kind of thing. It looks silly and they refrain from taking these loans and they look very clever. When we take the same students and make them poor in time, they really feel they need a few more seconds. They grab those high interest second loans and run out of time too quickly and leave the lab with less pay.
And they do that because you've got all kinds of challenges flying at them that they can't address because they have a lack of resources.
Beautiful. They're focusing on trying to solve a problem right now, and they feel like what they need the most is a few extra seconds. If you don't let them borrow, they do better with this very little time. But once you let them borrow, they focus on wanting a few more seconds. They grab them. They look like they're myopic. They look like they're not planning well. They grab the few extra seconds. It costs them a lot, and they leave with less money.
Take away the buffer of wealth and the behavioral differences can change in a hurry, the research says. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think that your guest needs to distinguish between hunger and nutrition. There's a difference. You can feel hungry and still have nutrition, and you can have nutrition, good nutrition, and not feel hunger. And I think that's where Americans come in to the point where they waste their income on trying to satisfy their hunger compared to satisfying their nutrition. For example, there's a store where you can get a very good cereal, 100% of your vitamins and iron with fiber, takes a cup each morning with some milk. And I guarantee Americans will not buy that cereal because it doesn't satisfy their hunger. They'll buy, you know, other fruity brands and sweets and stuff of cereals to satisfy their kids' hunger for something, but not try to satisfy their nutrition. And I think if Americans focus on satisfying my nutrition and not trying to satisfy hunger, people would do a lot better.
James, I understand your point. Of course, if you look at our food supply system, there's an awful lot of high-calorie, low-nutrition food that gets pushed at people. But what about the quality of choices on this front, Eldar Shafir, when resources are scarce?
Well, again, the caller makes some fine points. I'm not a nutritionist. What's important to keep in mind is the following. All the evidence suggests, both ours and other people's, that the task of eating well requires bandwidth of exactly the kind you have too little of when you're struggling to meet your financial juggling daily needs. As we'll make your financial juggling easier, all the evidence shows people spend more time and are much wiser at taking care of their nutritional needs.
But put you under the pressure of poverty, and that may have a corrosive effect on the quality of those decisions. I mean, our caller says, think right, do right, maybe hard when the chips are down. Chaz in Plattsburgh, New York. Chaz, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to talk about the root cause of these problems we have. You see, I teach mathematics, and if we are, let's say we are 10 people, and we allow everybody take, and we have $100, and we allow everybody to take as much as they want. And if one person takes $90, the second paid person takes $9, the third person 90 cents, the fourth person takes 9 cents, and then we have the rest of the people, 60%, who have one penny to fight on.
That's something like our economy, maybe a little exaggerated, but sometimes not so much. So what do you take from that, Chaz?
Exactly. We have to have a national discussion. We have really, as a wonderful discussion you have, that we have to have a relationship between the how much a person can gain and how much, you know, from the lowest level to the highest level. It cannot be without relationship because the wealth is not unlimited. There's a limited amount of wealth. So we have to have relationship between these two. And that's the problem is that there is no money left. And the rest of there is no money left. Jobs are cats. There are no jobs.
Chaz, our time is short, but I think we get the point you make. How do we, I don't know if your research goes to this, Eldar, but how do we align incentives so that we minimize the kind of impaired behavior that you describe, maximize the well-being of the society?
Well, it's a complicated question. I'll take Chaz on the following issue, which I think it links to some things we've done. Just think of the issue of empathy. One thing that we do in the book is describe the bandwidth limitations, the psychology that arises when you don't have enough time or calories or friends. When people are very lonely, they function less well. When people are very busy managing their time, they function less well. It turns out it's very similar for poverty. And if you understand that, you realize that the problems of the poor are not so different from ours. It's just that they happen in the context of money, where it hurts a lot more when you make mistakes.
Eldar Shafir's new book with Sandeel Mullanathan is Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and it may help inform our unresolved national debate over food stamps and SNAP and all the rest. Eldar Shafir at Princeton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your thoughts in this hour here and online. Great conversation there as well. Check it out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.